ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
That's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor, and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. Growing old with dignity in Australia hinges largely on one thing: owning the house you live in. But that's not a given for a growing number of us. For over 50s, unaffordable and poor quality housing is getting in the way of many people enjoying life's second act. That's according to new research. I'll tell you more about that in the next 20 minutes. Also ahead, you broke up because they didn't believe in marriage, and then they got engaged to the very next person. Why you can still find yourself mourning an old love, even though you know you just weren't compatible. It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, you've scraped together a hefty deposit, you've found a home you love in a price range you can afford. But then, on auction day, a flurry of bids goes tens of thousands of dollars above the top end of the price guide, and it doesn't even sell because it hasn't met the reserve price. And you hear later it sells for much more than that, leaving you clutching your real estate brochures and looking at your bank balance feeling disillusioned and shut out. Well, just last week came the news that under a new plan, real estate agents in Victoria will have to publish a property's reserve price at least 7 days before it goes to auction. And earlier this month, the New South Wales government announced it was considering reforms including mandatory and more transparent property price guides and fines of $110,000 or more if agents are caught underquoting. So, will these reforms create a fairer system? Will they help first home buyers? And big picture, will the changes do anything to address Australia's housing crisis? And you will hear from an economist in just a tick. But first, I've got with me Andrew McCann, Chief Executive of Jealous Craig Real Estate Agents, and Melinda Jennison, the President of the Real Estate Buyers Agents Association of Australia. Welcome to you both. I might start with you, Melinda. What are some of the common frustrations of buyers?
Look, it is absolutely not a surprise to anyone that the biggest frustration is when they think that they can afford to purchase a home and they spend money up front on completing due diligence to ensure that they're ready to buy, and then the price escalates well beyond where a quote range may have been or where a discussion may have taken place with the selling agent that's listed that property for sale, and they find themselves in a situation where they're back to square one, they're back to realestate.com or domain, and they're looking for new homes, hoping that next time the price will stay in the quoted range.
Mm. Andrew, you're the head of one of Melbourne's leading real estate groups. What are your view of the changes in Victoria?
Morning, Tegan. I think the changes in Victoria are a bit of a knee-jerk reaction at the moment, and I've been on record as saying I don't think that the publishing of a reserve price 7 days before an auction is going to solve the problem of underquoting. If anything, it's actually going to make it more complex. But I am a firm believer that we need to tackle the problem and we need to find a solution. We just need better conversation between the industry and the government, who have come out with these announcements only a matter of days ago without any collaboration with our industry at all.
What would you tell them if they asked you?
Well, I think we need to get to the knuckle of the problem, and that is that, you know, the quoted price range and the reserve need to correlate. I think that at the moment, the legislation in Victoria doesn't state that the vendor's reserve needs to have any reflection in the range that's advertised by the agency. And that lends itself to price manipulation and potential underquoting. But I think underquoting is misunderstood, because there are cases where properties will sell for a very high price due to competition, which has no reflection of the reserve price. But there are cases where agents are inappropriate in the way that they market property, and we need to stamp that out. But I think that the legislative change that's been suggested here actually just creates more problems, and it disadvantages the vendor and the seller, which will, in many cases, I think, just change the nature of the way that property is sold in Victoria.
Victorian Consumer Affairs Minister Nick Stakos has said the changes mean no longer will young prospective first home buyers have to waste their time on a property sales campaign when they could never afford the property in the first place. It's hard to argue with that. What do you say to that?
I think that's I have no argument for the statement, but I think that there's an irrelevance to the statement on many cases. The amount of properties that are, I suppose, coming through the system in Victoria is a large number. There are certainly pockets of Melbourne where we have seen challenges around real estate agency behaviour, but it is not the standard. It's not the norm, and I think that we have other options, which is to support first home buyers and people that are entering the property market, is to mandate pest and building inspections so that buyers aren't out of pocket. It's to ensure that when ranges are advertised, that the vendor's reserve price sits within the range at an appropriate time, probably closer to the auction than 7 days. And look, I'm not looking to hog the microphone, Tegan, but if I said to you, and you were selling your own home, 7 days out from an auction in Victoria, buyers don't have to register. They don't have to tell you whether they come into your auction to bid or not, and often they won't have their finances organised by 7 days prior to an auction. So if I had to have a conversation with you as the vendor and say, hey, it's time for us to set the reserve, we need to now 7 days out from our auction, where you've invested potentially $5,000, $10,000, or $15,000 of your own marketing money to promote your home, we need to now tell the marketplace what the minimum price that you will accept is for your home and see what happens in a week's time. And I could say to you at that stage, we're not sure who's coming because half of the buyers haven't told us that they're definitely attending. They may not have had their finance in place and they don't have to register. So that just the balancing in terms of the fairness of this introduction of potential legislation, it just doesn't quite pass the sniff test from where we stand, and we think it needs to be totally rethought.
Right. So a complicated system. This is just one part of it. Melinda, I can see you jotting notes down. Tell me what you're hearing when you're hearing Andrew here.
Look, I'm hearing a system in Victoria that is very unique to that state. And of course, what's difficult for buyers to understand is that every state has its own legislation and therefore its own process when it comes to purchasing a property, either by private treaty sale or by auction. And these new proposed legislation changes in Victoria are unique to Victoria, and these are not things that happen in any other state or jurisdiction around Australia. So I can understand the frustration of those that are in the profession in that state. Registrations, for example, for people attending an auction in other states are required. So that means that a vendor and a selling agent will have a much better understanding of the buyer interest on any particular home well before the auction takes place. Although in some states, for example, in Queensland, registrations can take place right up to the point when the hammer falls. So someone could register even once an auction has already commenced. I'll also say that, you know, in other states, for example, here in Queensland, we do have a situation where it's quite common for a vendor to provide a building and pest inspection report. And I think that it's important for buyers to understand the ramifications for relying on reports provided by a vendor or their selling agent as well, because there's a level of scepticism from buyers as to whether those reports may have been manipulated, whether certain elements may have been omitted from those reports. And so it's really, you know, I guess all of these things come from a place of mistrust. And it's really unfortunate that our industry has the perception that real estate agents can't be trusted. And therefore, buyers are looking for ways to provide certainty that what they're purchasing is, in fact, you know, what they think it is.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, talking to buyer's advocate Melinda Jennison and Andrew McCann, who's from Jellis Craig, a big real estate group in Victoria. Lisa says, I recently drove my sister many kilometres looking at properties and going to auctions that went for more than $100,000 over asking price. When my sister was asking the agents for the reserve, they'd say they didn't know yet. A few weeks out from the auction, I would expect the agents to know. Says Lisa, it was horrible seeing her spirit crushed each time the bids went way over the highest price range advertised. She eventually got something in her price range, but further out than we all wanted. Anne says underquoting's been a problem for over 30 years. A solution would be for vendors to be required to provide a building report from an independent government, Anne says, inspector. This would save some of the upfront costs for potential buyers. One person, though, has a question which I might put to you, Andrew and Melinda. Easier to understand buyer's disappointment. Why do real estate agents underquote? What is the benefit to them? Could you please ask your guests to explain? Andrew, what's in it for you?
There's nothing in it for us in underquoting. So I think that that's in itself, from a reputational point of view and from a point of looking to improve our industry, I'm a huge advocate for eliminating the terminology in itself. But if you do, if you want to dig deeper and figure out the perspectives of an auction and why do the bigger question is why do vendors look to take their properties to auction and why do agents recommend it? And it's because in certain markets in places like Melbourne, in inner Melbourne, there's great competition for homes. There are more people that are looking to buy quality real estate in Melbourne than there are homes available for sale. And owners are looking to capitalise and maximise on the opportunity for themselves to get the best possible sale price. So you look to put yourself in a competitive environment and you would choose an auction campaign to try and sell. Now, an agent, in a quoting perspective, is obliged to take the property to the market at the price of which they've appraised the property for. So if I said, I thought your home was worth $1 to $1.1 million, that's my personal opinion based on evidence, based on facts of other homes that have sold, and that's how the property should be positioned in the market. Now, if it sells for $1.2 due to market forces, that's because the property has been popular. It hasn't been underquoted. When it's underquoted is if I've said to you, I think your home is worth $1.2 to $1.3 million and the range is presented to the marketplace at $1 to $1.1. That's price manipulation and that's underquoting and that's illegal in the state of Victoria. So that's probably an opportunity to put some context to the two differentials. And I understand the frustration for buyers who attend competitive auctions and miss out frequently, but I think it's really important to put context to that's an issue that we have across Australia because we have a housing shortage. Mm-hmm. We have a government that needs to provide more housing and more affordable housing, and housing is, at the moment, in shortage, and therefore there is demand for it, and prices are going to continue to rise through the competitive nature of the markets that we operate in.
Melinda?
Look, I agree wholeheartedly with those statements, especially in relation to the imbalance between the number of properties that are available for sale and the volume of buyers in some markets or some subsections of the market. And it's absolutely correct to state that you can always provide an objective value based on the most recent comparable sales of where a home should sell. However, market forces will ultimately determine who wants that property most. And an auction environment, it's a pressure cooker environment. Of course, when buyers are all competing against each other and they can see their competition, quite often it results in emotive bidding and people will stretch to buy a home that they've fallen in love with. And we see that often as well. However, I guess the differential is when agents are deliberately trying to create exponential competition, which would not otherwise exist, when in some states where bidders do need to register, when they can make a statement in the opening of an auction to say we've got 25 registered bidders, when in reality 20 of them potentially will be wiped out by an opening bid, that gives them an edge in terms of hyping up the emotion of the buyers at that auction. And this is the behaviour that really needs to be cut out.
Also with us is Richard Dennis, who's an economist and co-CEO of the Australia Institute. Richard, we've seen plans come out from Victoria and New South Wales. Do you think they're going to make things fairer and more affordable for home buyers?
Oh, they might make things a little bit fairer, but to be crystal clear, they're not going to do anything to make houses more affordable. And that's the problem here. So again, to be clear, I think that either obliging sellers to organise inspections, as we have to here in the ACT, or having some transparency about reserves, that's fine. That's good. Yes, you know, that'll be slightly better for buyers and some sellers won't like it. But we have to be very careful here. There's a lot of policy as performance art occurring. Oh, I mean this. Politicians are trying to do anything they can to shift attention away from what the government is doing, which is nothing, to actually drive down house prices and put the blame onto anyone else they can. Local government, state government, property developers. There's this enormous blame shift going on because what no one wants to say is that most people in Australia making policy about housing don't want house prices to fall. Let me just say that again and choose my words carefully here. The Prime Minister doesn't want house prices to fall because most of Australians are already bought a house and are paying it off or have paid it off. So far more Australians want to see house prices go up than down. But obviously a lot of young people wish they'd come down. And in order to avoid answering the simple question, do you want house prices to go up or down, we get this performance art of government saying, oh, let's make this small change to how auctions work. Oh, let's blame councils for not approving medium density residential redevelopments fast enough. Like, there's all of these kind of tiny partial solutions that sound good, and I'm not actually opposed to them. But to be crystal clear, they're not actually going to lead to house prices coming down. And unless house prices come down a lot, young people working as nurses, working as teachers, working in childcare simply will never afford to buy a house in Australia. So, you know, I don't criticise this change being proposed in Victoria, but whether it passes or not, what we're all, everyone listening today to this needs to understand that we don't think people who work in childcare should be able to buy a house in Australia, because no tinkering with how auctions work is going to change that fundamental reality. And that's not how it used to be in Australia. That's not how it is in most countries. We've made a lot of choices to get us into this mess. But to be clear, the federal government and state governments don't really want to see house prices fall, which means they don't really want to help young people working in teaching, nursing or childcare.
What choices would be required to get us out of this mess then?
Oh, well, Australia used to spend a lot of money building public housing, which wasn't stigmatised. And to be clear, the Prime Minister lives in public housing. Most vice chancellors live in public housing. We have a Defence Housing Authority that provides public housing to soldiers. We used to just have a lot of public housing that wasn't stigmatised. It was just made available to people that needed a house to rent. And we don't do that anymore. So there's a big reduction in supply. And at the same time, we've introduced things like the 50% capital gains tax discount. Peter Costello and John Howard did this, and that's driven an enormous amount of money to flow out of the share market or out of small business and into owning residential rental properties. And the consequence of that is that it's so profitable, the 50% capital gains tax discount makes it so profitable for people to buy 2, 3, 4, 20 houses that it's when the first home buyers show up at the auction, that's who they're bidding against. But they're not just bidding against the wealth of those people, they're bidding against the tax concessions those people will get. And if you look at a graph, it's quite obvious the minute we introduced that tax concession, house prices surged and have continued to surge for decades. So to be clear, other countries don't do that. We didn't used to do that. And until we fix those structural problems, the incredible tax generosity we give to rental property owners and the absolute lack of investment in public housing supply, that's why supplies declined, right? Because we used to build them and we don't anymore. If we don't want to fix those two things, what better excuse for a government that doesn't want to fix those two things than to blame the real estate agent for being, you know, shonky at an auction?
Melinda?
Look, I would just like to say that whilst those tax concessions have come into play, it's the private mum and dad investor that are supplying housing for everyday Australians in the absence of the government providing this housing. So in the event that we didn't have the private investors actually purchasing properties, we'd have an even more horrific crisis in terms of our rental situation across the country. And right now we've got not enough rental properties available, let alone not enough properties available to purchase. So these are structural issues, absolutely.
That's just not true. Let me just be crystal clear. That's
briefly, Richard, but yes, please, go.
Oh, it's just not true. So when a mum and dad, whatever, who cares whether you've got kids or not, when someone buys an investment property, they're competing with a first home buyer. That doesn't increase the number of houses available. So this is just silly to suggest that that thanks to tax concessions, when people wanting to buy their fourth or 17th property show up at the market, they're increasing the supply of housing. No, they're not. They're just transferring housing from owner occupiers to investment properties. So if we wanted to just focus on supply, you'd just put the tax concessions on people building new houses. What's the point in offering tax concessions for people who buy an existing house to rent it to somebody? So, you know, we just have to be honest about this, that what's happened in Australia is it's so profitable for people to buy existing houses and rent them out to somebody else that the people that are doing that are the ones that pay the most at the auction.
No matter who's owning or renting the houses, we're actually going to talk about housing and rental supply just next year on Life Matters. So I do have to say thank you to Richard Dennis, co-CEO of the Australia Institute, Andrew McCann, Chief Executive of Jealous Craig, and Melinda Jennison, President of the Real Estate Buyers Agents Association of Australia. Thank you all so much for sharing your insights this morning and for your texts. Raman says, I ended up paying $46,000 more than the advertised price. We were expecting $10,000 to $15,000 difference. Now we're paying a higher mortgage. I believe it's a good move to make it more transparent. Well, we've got a fair bit of housing coming up here on Life Matters. Next week, we are talking housing and design with none other than Kevin McLeod from Grand Designs and mid-century design maven Tim Ross. We'll be talking about the building that moved you, how shows like Grand Designs shape our expectation of what a good home should look like, and yes, how Australia should tackle its housing crisis. That's Grand Designs' own Kevin McLeod and Tim Ross with me here next Wednesday on Life Matters. But coming up next, can't stop, won't stop talking about housing. Are you finding it harder to keep a roof over your head as you get older?
They prayed, they preached, they rebelled. From God Forbid, this is the Religious Rebels podcast, the stories of people who defied empires and sometimes paid with their lives. From Joan of Arc's battlefield visions to Malcolm X's final revelation, we tell the stories of those who defied faith and remade it. Religious Rebels, the original disruptors. Search for God Forbid ABC wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
There's a pretty common trope that you hear about older people and housing, and it usually starts with a gripe along the lines of baby boomers have it so good, they bought a house when they were cheap and now they're all millionaires. But it's not that simple. Over the last decade or so, there has been a 73% increase in older people renting, many of whom who are re-entering the rental market after an unexpected change like divorce or death or job loss. If you're over 50, new research shows that unaffordable and poor quality housing is getting in the way of living a dignified second act. And whether you make payments to the bank or a landlord, it doesn't really matter. Houses that are affordable and in good condition are in the minority, no matter whether you rent or own. Lynette Stevens is living this right now. Lynn, earlier this year, you had to leave your long-term rental. Can you tell me the story?
Yes, I did. I moved into the rental in 2012 and I remained there till the middle of this year where I found a placement in community housing thanks for the wonderful work of an organisation by the name of HAG. And I had to rent in 2012 because my marriage broke down and I had to get out of the marital home. The divorce was very messy and expensive, and therefore I come away with very little. And I worked, and I worked for myself, and I continued to do that till 2023. And I had a decline in my health. I'm currently waiting for two knee replacements. And I've been waiting since 2018 for that to take place. But my knees didn't allow me to continue to work, and then I started to experience difficulty in meeting my monthly rental payments, and it continued till I started falling behind in rent, and I lived every day thinking that I was going to end up getting an eviction notice or being taken to court to extract the rental arrears out of me.
That sounds...
But I live in a fantastic community now, so it's wonderful.
So you've managed to move into something from Housing for the Aged Action Group, HAG. You mentioned them before. We'll hear from them in a minute, actually. But, Lynn, your story really illustrates the sort of work that has been shone a light on with this new research from Swinburne University. We've actually got the lead author from that study here as well. Perrette Viroa is the lead author. Perrette, tell me about this research that you've just published.
Thanks for having me. So our research, we were looking at midlife and older Australians. So we are talking about people who are age 50 years and older. And we were looking how housing affordability and housing conditions combine to understand who is most affected by precarity. And we call this double precarity: homes that cost too much or are in poor condition or both.
So double precarity, this idea of both being unaffordable and then also not a very good condition, so you're potentially paying more money for it or it's a worse place to live. It's not just an issue that's affecting renters, Perrette.
No, we actually looked to 10 years that we consider more precarious. So we looked at people in private renter sector and owners with a mortgage.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking with Perrette Viroa, Dr. Perrette Viroa, lead author of a new research from Swinburne University, and Lynette Stevens, who's living in community housing now, which is great, after a long-term tenancy that became more and more precarious for her as she was struggling to make her rental payments. One person says, I'm a 50-something male, have been living in what is essentially an illegal rooming house since the pandemic. Everyone I've seen come and go has some kind of mental health issue, not sustainable for anyone. Another says, I own half a house with my ex. He pays high rent while I live in the home. We can't afford to renovate a rundown and shabby home. If we sell it, it won't translate to two separate homes. I'm really stuck. Perrette, where we live can really impact our health. What does your data show?
Yeah, our findings showed that health impacts can be really stark. In these homes that we were talking about, unaffordable, poor condition housing, and especially among private renters, more than half people reported poor physical health, and nearly half reported poor mental health. And that was way lower compared to people who lived in affordable, good condition homes.
Perrette, there's a gendered nature to this problem.
Yes, that was another key finding that we saw, that women were more likely than men to live in unaffordable, poor condition housing. They also reported more housing problems. So these were things such as, you know, cracks or structural issues, mold, plumbing issues. And we also found that women reported worse well-being outcomes when we are thinking about, again, mental and physical health, but also social connections or social ties and financial circumstances as well.
Well, we did hear Lynn mention HAG before, Housing for the Aged Action Group. We've got the Executive Officer, Fiona York, with us too. Fiona, welcome to Life Matters.
Good morning.
What's unique about the housing needs of this older cohort?
We've been really concerned about housing precarity for older people for a long time. The reason that we're concerned about it is because it's really difficult for people to age well and age with dignity if they're living in poor quality homes that cost too much. And so as this research shows and as Lynn's story illustrates, there are a lot of older people who are really struggling to be able to meet the basic needs that they have. So having a roof over their head, but also with the poor condition homes, things like mould is affecting their health. People can't get in and out of their homes up and down steps, which is obviously an issue when you have mobility that impacts you. And it can be something that is as simple as having an accident that catches up with you later in life, or losing your job, or having a divorce that puts you in this position. And none of those things should end up with people homeless. But that's the reality of our housing system at the moment.
In the research, there's a graph that really stood out to me talking about people who had mortgages. 49% of people aged 50 to 64 had $300,000 or more still owing, which feels like a lot for that age of your life.
Yeah, it's a scary graph, isn't it? I think one of the things that we're calling for as a result of this report and other reports that we've done looking at people that are in precarious housing in the mortgage with a mortgaged home is for the government to extend the assistance for them. So there is currently a program that assists people over 65 that are in mortgage stress, but we'd like that to be dropped to 55 because we recognise that there are a lot of people, as you say, that have quite a lot of money to pay off on their mortgages. And because of that low quality housing as well, it means they're unable to retrofit their homes. They're unable to get insulation and take advantage of some of the things like, you know, solar panels and those rebates and things, which make thermal comfort and make, you know, be able to age well. We also know that older people are more affected by heat waves. And so it's really, really important to have a quality home as well as an affordable home as you age.
Lynn, the house that you were living in, that really was your home for 10 years, the condition of it was part of what fed into the difficulties you were having.
Yes. As my mobility deteriorated, there were stairs at the front of the property, and I would have to basically crawl up the steps because there was no handles or railing either side. There were steps inside the house, which made it difficult once again. While I was working, I used to do a lot of the repairs myself, nothing major, but, you know, if something broke, I would just go down to Bunnings and get what I need and fix it. The owner of the property, I dealt with him directly, and he had short arms and long pockets when it came to investing in his property. And there's lock on the security door. Failed to exist as time went by, but he wasn't willing to put any money towards the investment property. I did try many years ago to ask him about working out some sort of way we could jointly put air conditioning into the property, but he wasn't forthcoming in wanting to do that, which would have made it comfortable for me to live. And of course, as cost of living and household utility bills increased, in the winter, it was because I live in Melbourne, could get quite cold, and I would sparingly use the heater because it was very expensive to run, which affected. I have trouble dealing with the cold, so it would affect my mobility and quality of life
It sounds...
I just couldn't get warm.
Lynn, I'm so sorry. And I can just imagine how that would feel if your joints were sore. Fiona, what do you feel when you hear Lynn's story?
Yeah, I think Lynn's story, unfortunately, is all too common, and it's really great for us to be able to hear from the people that the research actually is affecting. So lots of people that are making decisions are looking at lots of numbers, and I think what's really important to remember when we're looking at these percentages and these numbers in this housing debate and this housing crisis is that each one of those numbers has a human face and is a life. And Lynn is an example of this, I think. It's a really horrible story, but it's all too common in the private rental market where people are unable to live a good life because of the poor quality housing and the stress of paying the rent and then paying the mortgages too.
So how do we turn this around?
Well, we'd like to see government actually make a target to address older people's housing. So we'd like to see an increase in public and community housing so that it's at least 10% of all of the housing stock. But we also like to see some targeted assistance for older people because we think they are a bit of a hidden cohort. People like Lynn don't necessarily come knocking on the door asking for assistance. They do manage, as you can probably tell, you know, she's quite happy to go down to Bunnings and sort herself out and isn't asking for help. So there's a lot of people out there that have made do for many, many years, and we recognise that they're hidden and that they need special assistance. So we'd like to see a allocation for low-income households for people that are over 55 via the Housing Australia Future Fund and via the state governments as well. And there's a range of other things that we'd like to see around improving the quality of the existing housing stock as well as new builds. So Perrette's research demonstrates that housing that was built pre-1990 is particularly, affected by this. And so we need to have retrofitting a program for existing housing stock. And one of the things that is, you know, if people are going to be getting tax incentives for providing housing, then they should also be spending money to make that housing of good quality because it is people's lives that we're talking about.
How do people get in touch if they want to see what HAG can do for them, Fiona?
So unfortunately, we're only in Victoria if you're an older person that requires assistance, but we can probably put you in touch with a local service, although we are unique, I should say, in Australia. You're most welcome to come to have a look at our website, which is oldertenants.org.au, or you can give us a call if you're preferring to do that. And the phone number for that is 1300 765 178.
Lynette, Fiona, Perrette, thank you all so much for joining me. Lynette Stevens is living in community housing now after leaving a long-term tenancy. Fiona York's the Executive Officer for the Housing for the Aged Action Group. Their website's oldertenants.org.au. And Dr. Perrette Varoja, the lead author from a new research paper from Swinburne University that we've been discussing today. And thank you for your stories you've shared on text as well. Kate in Carlingford says, I'm in my late 40s. My husband is in his 50s. Between us, we have four children. I purchased my first home at the age of 20, but due to a divorce, I ended up renting. Since then, I have moved 15 times in 20 years. Even when I saved the money for a deposit, I was told repeatedly that my dependents outweighed my income. And Alex says, one thing I've noticed about ageing and housing that's not being talked about is the cost of putting a partner into aged care. The cost for one of my friends is $680,000. She has to sell her long-term family home, and there's not enough money remaining to buy somewhere for her to live. This is one reason so many women end up living in cheap rentals or a van or on the street. This cannot be right, Alex says. Something has to change. Well, stick with me here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Up next, grieving a future you hoped for when someone else is now living the life you'd imagined for yourself.
Compelling encounters.
What's been your most confronting experience?
What would your dying wish be?
You've done your homework, haven't you?
And Lee Sales is returning as our mentor.
Compelling ideas.
There's always been disruptors.
Compelling vision.
The actual sky had flame in it.
Compelling stories.
If you can change sport, you can change the wider society.
The Assembly, Annabelle Crabb's Civic Duty, I Was Actually There, and Endgame with Tony Armstrong. All these and more where it's always free, always compelling. ABC iView.
Every fortnight, our resident psychologist, Christine Bagley-Jones, joins me for a chat that we call Head and Heart. We usually dissect something in the zeitgeist, but today I'd like to try something different. I'm handing the topic over to you, our audience. Listener Sarah has sent us a dilemma she's facing and she'd like Christine's take. Christine, are you ready to hear Sarah's story today?
I'm excited, Tegan.
I'm excited too. Let's hear Sarah's dilemma.
Hi, Christine. This is a bit of a funny one. 7 years ago, I broke up with my then partner, Mike. We've been together for 4 years, but he didn't want to get married or have children, and I did, and I still do. At the time, we were in our mid-20s, and there were a couple of other things wrong with the relationship, but this was the key issue. And I'm now in my early 30s. I've had a few short-term relationships since, but I'm still looking for Mr. Right. I am, though, still close mates with Mike's best mate, Charlie. And over the weekend, Charlie and I caught up, and he told me Mike is now engaged to the woman he met after we broke up. I felt this overwhelming rush of anger and I just burst into tears. Like, I don't understand why, because I'm not carrying a torch for Mike and I haven't had feelings for him in years, but the thought of him marrying someone else while I'm still single just makes me furious. What is wrong with me?
Oh, this is a thorny one, hey? And I feel like it's quite relatable.
Completely. And first up, I feel really sorry for Sarah that she was just going for an innocent coffee catch up and suddenly she gets this unexpected intel, which I'm sure would have knocked her sideways.
Yeah, I mean, you can't ever predict when you're going to get that, any kind of blindsiding information. Like, they often do happen over a coffee catch up, but you don't know it that morning when you're getting dressed and going out to meet your mate.
And it could throw you for days, if not weeks, as it brings up all this old stuff that you probably haven't visited for such a long time.
Yeah, it's so what I'm hearing in Sarah's voice is sort of a grief over the loss of a future that you hoped for and then anger that someone else is now living that life that you'd imagined.
Yeah, I imagine there'd be a cocktail of emotions that would come up from that. The first thing would be that frustration of, but hang on a second, you didn't want this. And now you're living it with someone else. So there'd be that cognitive dissonance that comes with information that doesn't add up and her having to catch up. Oh, okay, right, now you want it, but just not with me. And now what does that mean?
Yeah, you said you didn't want this, but what you really mean is you didn't want me.
And it might not be as simple as that. And that's where I don't want Sarah just to jump to that conclusion, because there's a whole myriad of factors that make someone decide on these really big life ticket items. So it might not be as simple as, oh, I now have met someone I do want to do this with. I just didn't want to do it with you. It still could be a timing thing, even though he's with the person that he was with straight after their breakup. He may have only just recently arrived at the decision to have a family because the timing wasn't right when they were together. So it's very important for people not to quickly jump to that conclusion that, oh, okay, it's not that he didn't want kids, he just didn't want them with me, because it usually isn't that obvious.
Is a story like this something that you see much in your own practice?
Yeah, I see it frequently. I see that and lots of other similar stories of the human condition and the complexity of relationships and how deeply it penetrates when we invest in something so valuable as a potential life partner. And then when it falls apart, it brings up not just the loss, but it brings up issues around identity. And we get that sort of identity loss, I guess, because it's like, I was this person, we were heading on this path. I did believe for a period of time we were going to have that family. And then when that breaks down, they often come to counselling because they're like, well, who am I now in this story? And also, I'm really feeling these really unusual, strong feelings that need to be understood.
What is it where, so this person, Sarah says they broke up 7 years ago. Sounds like she's living a great life. She sounds happy. But hearing that news transports you back in time to that moment and how you felt then. What's going on there?
Well, it is that identity residue. It's like, I really was with that person. I invested. There's so much change that happened in my life. And I think she mentioned she was in her early 20s. So it's a really big opportunity for change and milestones. And that's where we start fantasizing about our future. So all of that gets bundled up and it becomes so impactful. As we get older, these disappointments don't feel necessarily as strong, but, you know, we have all these romantic notions and we're watching everybody else, you know, on a similar path as well. So we can't help but look sideways and see how we're tracking.
So we've sort of unpacked a little bit about what's happening. I guess the next question is like, what do you do about it? How do you process this and make peace with it?
I think it's really important that she takes some time out to try to figure out what's behind some of the top note feelings. That initial feeling of frustration and anger and disappointment is relevant, but what's it saying about where she's at and what she needs? Because we don't want her to just spiral into this feeling of maybe regret, like, oh, if I'd stuck it out, maybe it would have worked out, or what's wrong with me, or how come he's forging ahead having the life I wanted but with someone else. So take the time to understand what's behind these initial feelings, what it means for you, and what you can proactively do about it, what's within your sphere of influence.
How useful is it to Instagram stalk his new fiancé asking for a friend?
Not useful at all.
Not even a little bit.
It's Tegan, I can see the temptation, and God knows I would be leaning into it with my little fingers at night. But the reality is, it is perfectly normal and you should have all these feelings guilt-free. But you sure as heck don't act on some of these feelings of, you know, revenge or wanting to send off, well, you don't know what he's really like, or unless there's something serious involved in the relationship where it was unsafe and it needs to be flagged, you got to let that ship sail and not over-identify with it anymore and do the work on yourself to be relieved of it finally, and maybe double down on what your goals are rather than lingering in his world and his life, because that's a different narrative now. It's not part of yours. You need to detach from it completely.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor chatting with Christine Bagley-Jones, a psychologist based here in Brisbane, for our regular segment Head and Heart. And today we have Sarah, who's sent us a voice note about a breakup that she had a long time ago, but it's all come back up to the surface for her because she's found out that this guy who she broke up with 7 years ago, who said he didn't believe in marriage, is now engaged to someone else. One person says, maybe Mike has realised as he's matured that he made a mistake and doesn't want to lose someone again. That's a very generous way of interpreting this person on the text line. What do you reckon, Christine?
Oh, I love that. And I do believe in that sentiment. I think that we learn through our experiences. And Mike might have just been fresh to the idea. And when Sarah flagged it maybe multiple times in their relationship, he just decided, carte blanche, I'm too young, or this isn't what I want. And then things can happen. All sorts of other, it's not a linear experience. You get all these other happenings during your life that can then impact your decision making. And it would be a mistake for Sarah to just think that it was something directly related to their relationship or herself.
In situations like these, how useful is it to have like a mantra, like a concept that you can kind of like pull your brain back to when you start getting a bit crazy, especially at Insta at 11 p.m., for example?
Tegan, I'm a huge fan of mantras because I do believe that the brain is available to be programmed. Obviously, we get conditioned by our environment and what we listen to. So why not script healthy ideas? So for Sarah, I would be walking around multiple times a day to say that, you know, I deserve love. I deserve to be happy. Someone else's story isn't a reflection of my value or worth. And I will get what I desire in my own good time.
I'm glad that your story is part of mine. Christine, thank you as always for joining me today.
Thank you, Tegan.
Christine Bagley-Jones is our resident psychologist. She joins me fortnightly for a segment that we call Head and Heart. And if you have a dilemma that you reckon Christine would be able to give some good advice on, which is any dilemma really, because she's great, send me a text, 0418 226 576, and the Life Matters producers will sort you out and how you can put your question to Christine. We spoke this morning about making house buying a fairer process, and there's been a huge response to it. Basically, the story here is last week there was news that under a new plan, real estate agents in Victoria will have to publish a property's reserve price at least 7 days before it goes to auction. And there was also an announcement a week earlier that the New South Wales government is considering more transparent property price guides and fines for real estate agents who are caught underquoting. The question is, will these reforms create a fairer system? Will they do anything to address Australia's housing crisis? Well, Richard Dennis, who's co-CEO of the Australian Institute, was not convinced.
oh, they might make things a little bit fairer, but to be crystal clear, they're not going to do anything to make houses more affordable. And that's the problem here. So again, to be clear, I think that either obliging sellers to organise inspections, as we have to here in the ACT, or having some transparency about reserves, that's fine. That's good. Yes, you know, that'll be slightly better for buyers and some sellers won't like it. But we have to be very careful here. There's a lot of policy as performance art occurring. Oh, I mean this. Politicians are trying to do anything they can to shift attention away from what the government is doing, which is nothing, to actually drive down house prices and put the blame onto anyone else they can. Local government, state government, property developers. There's this enormous blame shift going on because what no one wants to say is that most people in Australia making policy about housing don't want house prices to fall. Let me just say that again and choose my words carefully here. The Prime Minister doesn't want house prices to fall because most of Australians are already bought a house and are paying it off or have paid it off. So far more Australians want to see house prices go up than down. But obviously a lot of young people wish they'd come down. And in order to avoid answering the simple question, do you want house prices to go up or down, we get this performance art of government saying, oh, let's make this small change to how auctions work. Oh, let's blame councils for not approving medium density residential redevelopments fast enough. Like, there's all of these kind of tiny partial solutions that sound good, and I'm not actually opposed to them. But to be crystal clear, they're not actually going to lead to house prices coming down. And unless house prices come down a lot, young people working as nurses, working as teachers, working in childcare simply will never afford to buy a house in Australia.
That's economist Richard Dennis, who's a co-CEO of the Australia Institute, talking to me earlier this morning about what we can do to make buying a house fairer. And I really value your own experiences that you've shared with me on the text line today. One person says, I'm 65, not working, and live in Canberra. I'd like to downsize and live closer to my pregnant daughter in Wollongong. However, the prices are huge and my own home is worth less, even with double glazing, solar, and a 950 square metre block. When I find a cheaper place, I will still have to pay stamp duty and moving costs. I'm doubting whether I can afford to move now and I'm heartbroken. There's no incentive for people to downsize and have more housing on the market for young families. Another says, I think we have short memories sometimes. Someone working in jobs like childcare wasn't usually in a position to buy a house in the past either. Many low-paid jobs didn't pay enough to buy, but there were a lot more rental properties available. Landlords are demonised, but without property investors, there are no rentals. Well, Richard Dennis covered that point as well in the full story that you can listen to if you go back and listen to Life Matters on the ABC Listen app. How many times can say listen? It's also where you can listen to a different story that we did today about the quality of rentals that are out there, especially for older people. Go to the ABC Listen app, find Life Matters, and make sure you hit follow so that you never miss an installment of Life Matters. And we are just doubling down on the property stories at the moment. Next week, we're talking housing and design with Kevin McLeod from Grand Designs and mid-century design maven Tim Ross. I'm going to be talking about the building that moved you, how shows like Grand Designs shape our expectation of what a good home should look like, and yes, how Australia should tackle its housing crisis. So make sure you come back here on Wednesday next week with Grand Designs' own Kevin McLeod in Tim Ross with me. Thank you so much for your texts. Lots of just generosity on the text line for Sarah, our question asker that I put to Christine Bagley-Jones. The bloke that she went out with a couple of years ago didn't believe in marriage, so he said at the time, and then now she's just found out that he is getting married. Your texts, one person says, I've lived with a man for 15 years. We went out 35 years ago. I wanted marriage and children. He didn't. Got back together after my marriage finished. Another says, the only thing in life that's guaranteed is change. There's a nugget of gold in here if she's ready to let go and see it. Another says the guy saying he didn't believe in marriage could be his clumsy attempt at saying, I've realised this relationship doesn't inspire me to want to marry you. Why do people these days think they can get through life without hurts? Our goal should be to try our best not to hurt others, but sometimes people we love don't feel the same about us, and vice versa. Well, that is almost it for Life Matters coming to you today from Jagera and Turrbal Land. Tomorrow on the show, I will be joined by Fashion Critical, Australia's favourite street sweeper / online fashion critic. We're going to talk about growing into your style as you age. Plus, at the halfway point of the 2020s, what do you reckon this decade's legacy is going to be? Apart from COVID, of course. And crash test dummies. They're still based on men's bodies and women pay the price. That's tomorrow on Life Matters, but you can email me anytime, lifematters@abc.net.au. Catch you tomorrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.